Have you mastered the entrepreneurial skill of orchestration? It's the method for partnering your way to a powerful, extensive ecosystem to expand your capacity to serve customers with best-in-class service levels. Let's hear from John Cox.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast, a project of the Mises Institute, applying the principles of economics to start, grow, and manage your business. For free tools, resources, key takeaways, and actionable insights from each episode, visit Mises.org/E4EPod. Now, here's Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. At Economics for Entrepreneurs, we see entrepreneurial economics as the solution for all questions regarding the improvement of the human experience. An understanding of what motivates people spurs entrepreneurs to create and produce economic goods and services that people want to buy and enjoy. Entrepreneurs improve other people's lives one satisfied customer at a time. Within that framework, a single entrepreneur can serve a lot of customers with a lot of services through the mechanism of orchestration. Our guest today, John Cox, serves people by providing them with modern, affordable, well-maintained, secure, and well-located apartments for rent. He also serves investors by packaging investment units into funds to finance the purchase and upkeep of the apartment buildings. He's also an advisor to those investors. He's built an advisory and investment ecosystem. The way to identify the opportunity, of course, is through the lens of customers' needs and their dissatisfactions. John learned that many investment customers prefer one-stop service interfaces for financial management, including accounting, legal, investment management, and investment opportunity identification across a wide swath of private and public markets. How do you maintain that wide swath capability and a single point of contact interface and maintain impeccable best-in-class credentials and service? By adroit use of partnering and orchestrating the capabilities of a wide range of networked providers. We'll learn some very effective orchestration techniques from John. He holds a BA degree from the University of Illinois at Chicago, where he majored in accounting and political science. He received his JD degree from Illinois Institute of Technology, Chicago, Kent College of Law. He's the founder of Cox Financial Group Limited, which specializes in investment counseling, income tax planning, retirement planning, and asset protection. And he's chairman of Equity Property Management, LLC. As we'll find out, John has also devoted some of his time to changing California for the better through politics rather than economics. We'll learn about his creative, innovative, and wholly original efforts in that direction. But first, let's learn everything we can about orchestration from a lifelong entrepreneur with an outstanding track record of success. John, welcome to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Thanks for having me, Hunter. Great to be with you.
Well, it's a real pleasure and an honor for us. And we're speaking to you as an entrepreneur. You're a great and long-established entrepreneur. In fact, you chose entrepreneurship at the very start of your career. And so I'd like to go back there because that'll help people who are thinking about making the entrepreneurial choice. And as I understand it, you got a degree at the University of Chicago.
No, that's not quite true. It's the University of Illinois at Chicago.
Okay. Is there a difference?
Yes. University of Illinois is a different institution than the University of Chicago. I really started entrepreneurship even before that because my brother and I were tennis professionals and we decided to get into teaching tennis, and we would go around the public parks at our local community and hand out our business card. And we made a pretty decent buck just offering tennis lessons to people on the courts. That was the early start of my entrepreneurship.
Well, that's great. So you always had that instinct.
Well, you know, I always knew that if I wanted to make a living, I had to provide a good service and sell myself and get out there. And that's what we did. We went and approached people on the tennis court and offered our skills. And that's really what any entrepreneur does.
Well, that's right. And then so at the university, You got your degree, you got supplemental qualifications for the financial services industry, which I know is it's a very rigorous qualification. Yeah, so law school and finance.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, what I did was I first got my accounting degree. I didn't really know what an accountant was, but my brother was able to give me some guidance on that. And I got into a few accounting classes and loved it. And ultimately got a CPA certificate when I graduated from the University of Illinois. And then always had the goal of wanting to go to law school and be a lawyer. So it just made sense to be an accountant and a lawyer and specialize in business and tax and all the entrepreneurial kind of opportunities that went along with that.
And then you did join one of the big accounting firms for a while, right? Pricewaterhouse?
Yeah, it was actually called Coopers & Lybrand at the time, and it later merged after I had left with Pricewaterhouse. But yeah, you know, I had started at a small law firm first to get my feet wet and to get some grounding in tax law. It was a tax law firm that was pretty celebrated in Chicago. They had represented Jesse Owens, who was the famous athlete, but he had failed to file tax returns. And this tax law firm had gotten him, at least with a civil fine, when IRS went after him. But that law firm was small, and I wanted to get the training and really exposure to big clients. And so I took a job with this Coopers & Lybrand, which was then one of the top eight largest accounting firms in the world at that time. And it was a great training ground, Hunter. I, at the young age of 21 years old, I had graduated college in 2.5 years, accelerating with advanced placement exams. But at 21 years old, I just got great experience being sent out to do tax planning and review tax accruals for financial statements and being involved with large companies like State Farm, which was undergoing, audits and needed my help. And that was a good amount of great experience with a big firm.
And then quickly, John, you then started your own law and accounting firm. So what gave you the confidence and the ability, do you think, to move that quickly?
Well, I worked at Coopers & Lybrand while I was going to law school, so I was able to pick up a lot of experience in tax law while I was actually studying it in night school, in law school. And so when I got done with that law education, I certainly wanted to practice law for a little bit since I had gone all the way through the law school process. I actually was fortunate enough to graduate at the top of my class. And I got a really fine job with a big Chicago law firm, which was voted one of the top 100 small firms in the country. But after being there for about a year, I still had that urge to want to be out on my own. And I felt because of the experience I had at Coopers & Lybrand and the experience I had practicing law at this firm that I had the capabilities to hang out my own shingle. And that's what I did at the tender age of 25 years old. I actually hadn't yet turned 25, but decided to hang out my shingle and start my own business.
Yeah. Well, good for you. One of the questions our entrepreneurs always ask in the professional services business like that is, what's the process of getting your first clients and how did that go for you?
Well, that's kind of interesting because I had accumulated a bunch of clients when I was at Coopers & Lybrand. I had met people, neighbors, friends, other people who needed tax help, and they were too small to really be of any interest to the big accounting firm. And so I had been doing their work, kind of on the side while I was at, Coopers & Lybrand and my weekends and nights and things like that. So I had a decent set of clients already in my stable, as it were. So I was able to make a transition and actually have revenue coming in when I first started my business. I timed my leaving the law firm to be in January. So I was heading right into the tax season. So I knew I would have revenues coming in February, March, and April. from doing these few clients that I had. And then I just did what most, you know, business people do. And I just went out prospecting. I joined clubs. I talked to people at my church and in my neighborhood and got to know people and let them know that I was in my own firm. And if they ever needed any help, I would be very happy to help them. And because I was a young guy and I didn't have the big overhead that a lot of big firms had, I could charge a little less and actually make money, but provide a good service at a reduced cost to these clients, which they liked. And it worked out well for both of us.
Yeah. That's the perfect value proposition. And your experience in hustling tennis lessons got you clients in the accounting business, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I knew how to sell myself. I mean, I would talk to people and, you know, certainly was able to address what their needs were. I mean, people who needed tax help were either facing an audit or needed a tax return prepared or wanted to do some planning or needed a will or any number of things that I was able to do and had the expertise to do. And I think because I was a young guy and was eager, I think some people took a chance on me thinking that, well, I have the energy and the enthusiasm to do a good job for them. And it's funny, I still have some of those same clients today, hate to say it, 40 years later.
Yeah, well, that's great. That's a great testimony to your customer service and your capability. So the next question entrepreneurs always ask us, John, is, well, what's your growth strategy? There's a limit to how much the young man can handle in terms of new business, and the business grew, I know, effectively. What was your growth strategy and how did you execute it?
Well, interestingly, you know, this is 40 years ago. This is 1980, basically. So the personal computer, as you might know, wasn't really even a dream at that point in time or, you know, anything that people had thought about. But I decided early on when I started my practice to be technologically proficient. And at the time, there was only one company that was making anything close to a personal computer, and that was Digital. Doesn't exist anymore, as you might know. But I bought a digital computer and I bought a printer, and I was able then to print documents, do pension plans and estate plans very efficiently. And I grew with that. And by 1986, I had grown with technology again, and I went to the Apple system at that point in time, And then I had a network of Apple Macintosh computers. You might remember they famously came out in 1984. If you might remember, there was a big advertisement that they ran during the Super Bowl, if you remember.
I remember the ad, yeah.
But, you know, they really, really hadn't perfected it for small businesses until a couple years later. But in 1986, I had built up enough of a business, had a lot of lawyers working for me, and we had a network of Apple computers. And we ran a law firm. I had 13 lawyers working for me that year, and we ran it with one secretary. That's all we had. And her job was more to answer phones and handle postage and mail and things like that. All the lawyers did all their own letters and documents, and that was pretty far-reaching at the time. And again, it made us so much more efficient and so much more cost-effective that we were able to make a bigger profit at while charging the client lower cost, lower fees. And when you do that, the world will beat a path to your door. If you offer a service that's more efficient at a lower cost and better quality and more responsive, you're not going to want for business. And that's basically what happened with my law and accounting firms.
Yeah. What put you in that leading edge position, John? What was it about you or what you knew or the business you were in that made you adopt technology like that? I mean, you were a leading edge adopter.
I was. And it's kind of funny. I got lucky. My brother, I have to give credit to him. My older brother, Michael, preceded me in school. Obviously, he's a few years older. And he became kind of a tech geek. He was one of the first Apple advisors back when the Apple II had come out, and he had gotten into it. And, you know, he was continuing to tell me about it. And so I naturally gravitated to it based on his recommendations. And he's the one that helped me install that first Apple network. And I have him to thank. Unfortunately, he's left us now. He passed of a brain tumor about a dozen years ago. But I still continue to thank my older brother, who really helped send me on my way in terms of technology and being able to provide a good service at a lower cost.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear about your brother, but he was a strategic partner in that sense. I know in the venture capital business, when we look at founding teams, we like to have at least two partners, and one is typically the tech partner, and one's the creative partner or the sales partner or the business development partner. And it sounds like you and your brother were in that kind of a mode.
No question. And I, like I said, certainly have him to thank. But, you know, it was just great to be able to provide that service. And ultimately, we expanded the business. I had a major client who sold their business. It was a potato chip manufacturer in Chicago. And I immediately decided that since they were selling their business, they probably would need some investment advice. And they trusted me because I had done a good job for them as lawyer and accountant. And so I started my own investment counseling firm to handle their investment. And they, in fact, provided the first seed capital for the real estate investments that I was interested in making. I had always been interested in real estate, and I knew that real estate had a tax advantage as well as an investment, was a great investment. And so the people that sold this business also needed to diversify their investments. And so it was kind of a good match for me to manage their investments and also to help them get into real estate.
Well, let's just go back a step, John, because I think there's a useful principle there for people. And one of my bosses in the consulting business said, go into businesses that your clients put you into. And in other words, if you know if they wanted your help in another field, that was a great signal that you should enter that. So it sounds like you're a little bit like that. You went into the investment business because you had a client that would encourage you to do so and become a client in your new field.
Well, and the good thing about that is that it wasn't like I was a brain surgeon and decided to go into dentistry because my clients needed dental work. You know, investment and management is very closely related to tax planning and estate planning and financial planning in general. I mean, it's a natural outgrowth because as a CPA and a lawyer, I knew how to analyze businesses from the ground up. I knew how to analyze financial statements since I had prepared financial statements. So it was not a reach for me to be able to grow into analyzing investments as an investment advisor, and then using my background in tax and legal matters to be able to give personal financial planning advice. I wasn't really equipped to actually pick stocks and bonds. And this is where another good lesson of entrepreneurship comes into play, Hunter, and that is you got to know what you don't know as much as what you do know.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that there were something like 10,000 publicly traded companies, and I didn't have the resources or the people or the background to analyze, you know, that many companies and winnow them down to the best opportunities for my clients. But I knew that there were firms out there that did, and I had a relationship with one in particular. It was called Stein, Rowan, Farnham, and it happened to be one of the top investment management firms in the country at the time. And I had been introduced to them because I had done the tax returns for the founder of the firm, whose name was Sidney Stein Jr. And so I knew about the firm, and so when this client sold their business and needed the investment help, I reached an accommodation with this investment management firm such that they would help pick the stocks and bonds I would do the financial planning, the tax planning, the estate planning, and all the personal counseling that was involved. And this big firm would charge me a reduced fee for picking those stocks and bonds, less than what they would normally charge someone just coming in off the street. And I basically did what's called a wrap. So they would charge me, let's say, 0.5%. I charged my clients 1 or 1.25%, depending on what kind of service I gave to them. And then I paid this firm. So the client didn't end up paying more than they would have paid if they had gone directly to this company. But they got the benefit of this investment counseling firm, this major big firm that had all these people working for them. And they also got the benefit of having me involved to handle their personal financial planning, their tax planning, their estate planning, and basically hold their hand and give them personalized advice. So, and that's actually been one of my main businesses ever since in the last 35, 40 years.
And the fancy term for all of that in the business textbooks, I think, John, is an ecosystem. You created an ecosystem of investments and real estate and law and accounting and so on. And the skill to manage that, besides the personal service skills, which obviously you have to a high degree, is orchestration. Not as you say, being able to do everything, but be able to orchestrate it so it comes together for clients. So did you think of yourself that way?
Orchestrator? You know what? Until you've said it now, I guess that is exactly like a conductor in an orchestra. Mm-hmm. This firm that did the investment management was the lead violin, if you will. And the estate planning and tax planning would be the horn section, and maybe the legal work would be another part of the orchestra, the percussion.
Yeah.
And I sat at the top of this, basically orchestrating the whole thing so that the client only had one person they personally dealt with, and that was me. But beyond me, there was the investment counseling firm, there were the lawyers who handled legal work, and then there was the accountants and the other people that did all the tax work. So they got a full financial plan done, but they didn't have to go and visit a separate accountant, a separate investment counseling firm, a separate law firm. And I made the argument a lot of times, Hunter, with potential clients, that it was a lot more cost effective and a lot more productive to have it done in one place. Mm-hmm. Lawyers and CPAs charge by the hour, and I was able to tell clients, well, if your accountant is talking to your lawyer, you're getting billed by both of them at the same time, which is certainly not very cost effective. On top of that, you may also then have to pay an investment counseling firm on top of that. And not only that, all three of those groups may not even talk to each other, which means that important pieces of information might fall through the crack. So, and not be dealt with properly. So I kind of made the argument that it was a much better idea to have it all orchestrated, as you say, in one spot. Now, there's a negative. Not everything is positive. The negative is that the client wouldn't have a second opinion, as it were. I mean, since I would be handling all those different aspects, they would, maybe not know if they were to miss things. So I always urge clients to get second opinions. I always urge them to look at the results that they were getting and compare them to what they were getting in, the rest of the world, or what the rest of the world was deriving in terms of investment results. And so given the volume of financial information out there, I think clients were pretty safe in assuming that, based on the results they got from us, and they could compare them with other people, that they were being treated pretty well.
We're listening to John Cox tell us about his absolutely fascinating entrepreneurial journey, from setting up his own professional services firm that utilized emerging technologies in new ways in accounting and law, to private equity M&A, to owning apartment buildings and eventually to running for governor of California, as we'll hear. All entrepreneurial journeys are fascinating, and all are different. Yours will be too. Learn some pointers about how to navigate yours with our Austrian Entrepreneur's Journey course, which you can obtain at e4epod.com/journey. That's the letter E, the number 4, the letter E, pod.com/journey. And now back to John Cox's journey. Yeah, so I'd like everybody to take away this idea in the service business of orchestration. It brings so many sets of knowledge and skills to bear for the client. And then, as you say, John, the client has a great experience in that it's personal and one-on-one with you or whoever their primary agent is. So it's a great system for the modern world.
It is. And of course, what ended up happening too is that the clients would have confidence in me. And so when I proposed to go out and buy certain pieces of real estate, they were interested in investing with me. And since I was very much involved and I was putting my own capital to risk, by the way, that's a very important part of it. They had a lot of confidence that I would devote the time and attention and the effort to making sure that those investments were successful. And that's, in fact, what happened. We continued to buy apartment buildings because I felt apartment buildings were the best investment. And today we now own almost 3,000 apartment units. I have the lion's share. I own about a 60% interest in overall in the properties. And but a lot of these clients have a piece of those properties, and we've just done very, very, very well, knock on wood, given what's happened to the economy in the last 30 years.
And Nassim Taleb calls that skin in the game, John, which, you know, it sounds a bit dismissive, but actually it's really, really important. The ability to give great advice and guidance to your customers is massively enhanced when you've got skin in the game, and you clearly have.
Yeah, and I kind of laugh when I watch a news show. I'm an inveterate watcher of Fox Business and CNBC, and invariably they'll have an analyst on, and you know the analyst will say, "Oh, you should buy this stock, and this stock is great, and this stock is great." And then they ask the analyst, "Well, you need to disclose how much of it you own." And the analyst says, "Oh, I don't own any of it. I don't have any shares of that company."
Yeah, in fact, they claim that as a qualification, right? They're unbiased.
Exactly. It's supposed to make them independent, and I guess maybe it does in one sense. But think about it: if you're recommending an investment to people and you don't have any of that investment yourself, I'm wondering how much conviction or how much knowledge you really can have that would say that you think it's a good idea to make that investment. I would much rather, I mean, one of the things that I quiz our investment counseling firm all the time is, you know, how much of the company does senior management own? I want senior management to have a lot of skin in the game. I want them to suffer or benefit from bad or good performance of the company, because I want their fortunes to ride right along with mine.
Yep. Well, I know you continue to run and lead these considerable businesses, John. You manage clients, but you moved from Chicago to here in California. You and I are neighbors in San Diego, but your properties and your offices are still in the Midwest. What advice do you have about managing long distance?
Well, fortunately, technology, again, has served me well. The internet, which frankly wasn't even a consideration when I started my businesses, of course, has grown and just led a complete revolution in management. I can get and download spreadsheets and real-time information on my cell phone today. It's really amazing. I guess you have to be our age to know how great that is,
because we'd be surprised at it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the young people today kind of take that for granted. But I remember when we got our first fax machine and it was a revolutionary thing. And now that's ancient technology. But you know, the ability to actually get real-time information and be able to communicate instantly even a cell phone is just a tremendous advantage to managing a business when you're far away from it. Now, doesn't mean I can stay far away from it. I go back to the Midwest and visit, you know, the properties and, you know, apply some hands-on management techniques to the staff several times a year. So they know who I am. They know I'm watching. They know I'm on the phone or I'm communicating with them via the internet on a regular basis. So I'm very, very hands-on. But I'm able to do a lot of the nuts and bolts of management and communicating over the internet. And that's just a tremendous advantage.
Well, one of the things you're doing for us citizens of the state of California, John, is applying your entrepreneurial thinking to the governance and administration of the state. And I think, well, let me not put words in your mouth, but I suspect that you find that it's not as good an atmosphere for entrepreneurship, certainly in your business, as perhaps the Midwest is. But how does an entrepreneur think about state government and its problems and how to change it?
You mean the corrupt swamp?
you could describe it that way?
And I would describe it that way. And it goes back to my mom and the experiences I had growing up. My mom was a Chicago public school teacher. And I grew up really without a father. She married my stepfather later on, but my mom was the matriarch. She was very political. She really studied politics. She lived it because she worked in the Chicago public school system. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, you don't get more political than a big city school system. And she witnessed what happens when politics intrudes and is corrupt, because frankly, that's exactly what happened. The principals that she had to work for, these are the people that were the heads of the school, right? These were the football coach of the school. These were the leaders of the school. And many times in Chicago, they were basically buddies of the local alderman. And they got their job because they were good at generating votes or money for the politicians. And they weren't really qualified for their job, especially if you sat in a room with my mom for any length of time, you would quickly discover that she had strong opinions about how poorly a lot of these leaders were supposedly, you know, there to lead their school.
Yeah.
And my mom chafed under that. And that meant we chafed under it because she was very vocal about the problems that she had. And I used to go with her to the school. And, you know, I was maybe, I don't know, 10 or 11 years old, and I would be going there and basically tutoring seniors at her high school that she taught at, who could barely read and write.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. And frankly, it's still the problem today. The schools are just like any political organization. They're not run very well. They're not managed very well. They're not dedicated to quality and efficiency. They're dedicated to just shuffling kids through in many situations. And that's something that stuck with me. And frankly, it does to this day. I just abhor that kind of political corruption. It cheats not only the taxpayers who think they're paying for something that's efficient and quality, but more importantly, it robs those children that deserve to get a better education. And of course, it's now present in all kinds of other things where there's just tremendous inefficiencies in many things that government does. Government just isn't built to be quality driven and efficient in many ways. It doesn't have a profit motive. And some people celebrate that. They think the profit motive is evil. But I look at the profit motive as a wonderful thing because it's what drives people to be quality and efficient. Because if they don't, they quickly go out of business. And that's not what happens with government. No matter how government does in terms of efficiency or quality, it stays in business. And in point of fact, a lot of times it even gets more power and control of money. And I know that doesn't sound like it makes sense, but that's exactly what happens.
No, in economic terms, we'd say the incentives are all misaligned. They're short term. They're in favor of interest groups. They're in favor of corruption in many cases. And that's...
Well, think about it. You know, you have a situation in Illinois and, frankly, here in California, which I discovered when I got here was almost worse than Illinois, in which the bureaucracy almost is disincentivized to improve itself. And why? Because by definition, a bureaucracy that improves its efficiency will have fewer people, will be able to produce as much with fewer people. Well, there's very little incentive to have fewer people in government because that means that public sector unions have fewer people to pay dues. Mm-hmm. It means that budgets are lower, which by itself means that there's less power. So in many ways, as you just said, the incentives are completely misaligned in government. And you would think that voters would hold their elected officials accountable on that basis. But as we know, a lot of times, unfortunately, the public has too many things going on or is apathetic and doesn't really pay much attention. And so politicians take advantage of that ignorance or apathy and are able to continue to perform at a lower level than what we voters and taxpayers rightly deserve.
Yeah. So I know you've taken an entrepreneurial approach to this problem, John. You've set up a couple of very innovative organizations to try and create that change and mobilize people. Can you speak to us a little bit about those?
Well, some would say I've tilted at a few windmills, but if you don't start somewhere, you don't end up in a positive situation. And
right.
Yeah. So, I've been working on several ideas and several reform ideas. I had one that you and I worked closely on called the Neighborhood Legislature. The concept was very simple, and that is the presence of money or the power of money is multiplied when political campaigns have to appeal to large numbers of people. And California has the largest legislative districts in the world, a Senate district's 1 million people, an assembly district's 500,000 people. And that's what gives power to these funding interests who then bend government to their own purposes. We came up with an idea to basically chop up these big, huge districts into small pieces so that money wasn't that important. And we devised a committee structure so that the numbers didn't overwhelm the state capitol. Still think it's a great idea. Someday we'll maybe be able to get the education that's needed to have people understand why it's a very good idea to limit the power of money in politics. But that one's going to take a little education, no question about it.
Tell us about Change California, which is something that you've just started and launched and is having great success.
Well, as you know, and many Californians know, I ran for governor in 2018. It wasn't necessarily considered to be a potentially very successful run since the Democrats have really controlled the state for some time now. But, you know, competition is important in politics as it is in business. And so I decided that the political powers in California did need that competition. And I was unsuccessful, but got a lot of votes, just not enough to win, and identified the real crux of the reason, and that is a huge block of unaffiliated voters that basically, I think, didn't pay that much attention to this race. They didn't know much about who I was, and they knew more about my opponent because he had a lot more money. And my thought is if those independent voters could be educated on the issues, that they would act to do something about some of the conditions on the ground here in California. As you know, and many of the listeners to the podcast know, California is widely considered to be pretty mismanaged. It's got the highest cost of living and the highest poverty rates. It's got the highest tax rates and the worst education results. Water is in threat of being rationed. Electricity is 5 times more than other states. Our gasoline prices, our housing prices are outrageous. And our homeless population is about 25% of the nation's homeless, and we only have about 12% of the nation's population. So the idea here is that there's a tremendous mismanagement in California, and change California is directed at educating the independent voters who would be needing, you know, to vote to change those conditions. And there's this big block of 6.5 million independent voters who, frankly, just haven't been paying enough attention. They don't vote at the same frequency that Republicans and Democrats do, and they need to be educated. So we are hiring military veterans. These are people that are trusted in the community and that have a good amount of moral support from the community. And we're paying them to go door to door and educate and get to know these independent voters. And hopefully these independent voters will get more involved and be willing to vote to get some change in a positive fashion in California. And I think it's very necessary.
Yeah. Well, thanks for doing that. And I know that you subscribe to the idea that it's education in the sense of learning and understanding exactly what is going on that will help people make good decisions. We certainly believe in that. Let me ask you about an entrepreneurial uprising which may be going on in California. The state recently passed it's called AB5, and it's known in the media as the anti-gig worker bill, but it restricts independent contractors, and it was done by the state to force people into unionized situations and increase union dues, among other reasons. But now a lot of people are rebelling against that, and I saw a headline that some writer wrote the other day that says it's turning Democrats into libertarians. They suddenly realize the state is taking away their economic freedom and their entrepreneurial independence. So do you think that's a promising development? We've got a libertarian uprising?
I do indeed. And I have talked to people who have been negatively impacted by this, and they're outraged. And you're absolutely right. It wasn't like there was a whole bunch of protests or marches by gig workers, people who work for DoorDash or TaskRabbit or Grubhub or any of these other, you know, services that have popped up because of the internet and because of the flexibility that's offered by being a gig worker. There was no uprising of that that necessitated this bill. This bill was plainly done by politicians who wanted to increase union representation. And of course, those unions would repay that favor with a lot of dollars and workers to get elected. And you're absolutely right. Freelance dancers, performers, makeup artists, translators, delivery people, drivers. Yes, it was probably directed more at Uber and Lyft than anybody else. But there's a whole huge flexible, what I call a flexible workforce economy out there that wants to be flexible, that values liberty, that values the ability to allocate their time the way they want. And these politicians decided to disrupt that whole effort mainly for the benefit of the politicians. And of course, the trial lawyers who are going to benefit, right? Because now you're going to have a lot of lawsuits. And frankly, what's happening is that a lot of these companies that would have used freelance people in California, like writers, it impacted a lot of writers. Mm-hmm. A lot of companies, a lot of websites, a lot of publishers who are not in California but used California freelance writers have decided it's not worth it because they figure they're going to get sued by some California lawyer for not providing the right benefits. And they think they can probably withstand the factual analysis of whether they have to comply with this law or not, but they don't even want to try. They're just going to give up and hire somebody else in some other state where they're not going to have to worry about fighting a trial lawyer someday. I mean, that is a real problem throughout this whole economy here in California, and that is the trial lawyers have been one of the biggest funders of politicians, and the politicians have rewarded them with new lawsuit opportunities at every turn. I don't know if you know this now, but it's now an actionable discrimination to discriminate against somebody because of their hairstyle.
Really?
Now, you know, you and I are both probably, we would consider ourselves follically challenged.
That's right.
But how are you ever going to show that you didn't fire somebody because of their hair?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's kind of ridiculous. I don't care what anybody's hair looks like. I'm going to have the best employees and have the best people working for me. But, you know, if you had to fire somebody because they weren't doing the right job and they happen to have a different kind of hairstyle, now you got to worry about, oh, gee, are they going to bring a lawsuit because I just fired them? They weren't doing the job, but they're going to contend that they got fired because of their hairstyle. It's just one more reason not to do business in California. Yeah. And that's going to hurt all of us in the long run.
Just for this this issue that's come up with the gig workers, one of our visions, John, is that the solution isn't politics. The solution is in economics and in entrepreneurial freedom. And I just wonder whether this is going to be an illustration that the gig worker economy grew through innovation and through entrepreneurship. It benefits people with an entrepreneurial spirit. Those kinds of people can build different ecosystems that maybe are independent of government. Is government coming to try and squish it? But we still keep out the hope that entrepreneurs like you are the ones who'll create solutions and find us a way to get away from government. So will you give us some hope?
That is some hope. But I would tell you, Hunter, the trouble is that if you have runaway, bought and paid for government like you have in California, I'm dubious that we're going to be able to innovate enough to stay ahead of the politicians. And that's a sad state of affairs, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
The beauty of the federal system that our country has is that we have 50 states and we have 50 competitors that are competing with each other. And I think that's more of my hope, that ultimately Texas and Utah and Nevada or Idaho continue to get more of our people and our businesses. And finally, people in California realize that, you know, they're in a losing enterprise here and that they better do some changes or else we're going to find ourselves underwater as a state. And I don't want to see that happen. I hope that we arrive at some solution for our political mismanagement well before that happens.
Well, John, we citizens of California thank you for leading the fight, and we congratulate you for being a great entrepreneur. Thanks for the lessons and advice and insights today. Is there any website or place you'd like to tell our listeners to go to on the web to find out what you're doing?
Yeah, certainly change-ca.org, change-ca.org. That's our website for Change California. And right now we're doing a test of this concept in the 48th district, and we're about to expand into the 45th and 39th district. These are very, very close, hotly contested districts in 2020. We believe that if this system works, hiring military veterans to just contact independent voters, that's as simple as I can make it. If this effort is, you know, bears fruit, then I think we could probably take this statewide and activate and empower these independent voters to finally make a change. And that's where I'm directed with this. And hopefully the people respond and we get something accomplished.
Good. Well, we'll leave the link on our webpage. And John, thank you very much for your valuable time today. And thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you, Hunter. I appreciate the opportunity.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's M-I-S-E-S.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out hunterhastings.com.